Hello. In this audio clip, we'll be talking about the United States Senate. And our intent is to more or less get a general sense of where the United States Senate originated. And by doing so, we'll be able to get a better sense of its underlying nature. And so after discussing the origins of the Senate and getting a sense of what the Senate is about underneath the surface, we'll look at, in a very general way, into some of the problems that have stemmed from that underlying nature, and how those problems have turned the Senate into a very subtly destructive force in the American political system. And the reason for talking about the Senate is that if we at some point are able to rewrite the Constitution, the Senate as a concept has to be completely removed and replaced with a unicameral legislature that will be organized in a completely different way. And hopefully in a future audio clip, we will discuss the types of changes that need to be made in our legislative system, and especially in a unicameral system, to ensure that we finally get a productive flow of legislation and a more democratic one where you don't develop pockets of power. But that will be for another audio clip. And before we go into this discussion of the Senate, I'd just like to mention that shortly after our previous audio clip on Chisholm versus the state of Georgia, that Supreme Court case back in the 1790s, there were news about a Georgia-based company called Colonial Pipeline that was hacked by Eastern Europeans, and these hackers paralyzed their entire system and forced this Georgia-based company to cough up, it is said, around $90 million. And that's when the hackers finally released the system, and Colonial Pipeline was able to more or less go back to normal. But in the meantime, it caused massive gas shortages in many parts of the country that depended on the Colonial Pipeline. So it's, I believe that's not a coincidence. It's fitting that we were talking the previous week about how Georgia treated a South Carolinian as if he were a foreigner, not like a fellow American, but a foreigner. And they said, we are a sovereign state and we are accountable to no one. So so you to us, South Carolinian, are as if you were a Russian or an Italian. And in fact, I was going to mention that as a joke, but that didn't, we didn't get to that. So it's interesting that now Eastern Europeans, who are really real foreigners, are in a sense returning the favor. And just as Georgia stole property from a fellow American, treating him as a foreigner, now Georgia was coughing up property, having their property stolen by actual foreigners. And I know it's not a coincidence that the name of that company was Colonial Pipeline, because we were talking about a case that happened very early into the birth of this nation, shortly after we had stopped being the 13 colonies and had officially become the United States. So I just wanted to mention that. I know that's not a coincidence. So we'll talk about the Senate a little bit. I'm not sure we'll be able to cover all the little points in this one audio clip, but if not, we'll split this clip into two. And I hope that as you hear all these things, that you will also see how the cancer of federalism is involved in the Senate and the problems it causes. So first, we have to go back in time and try to understand where this concept of a United States Senate came from. Who thought it up, and why did we end up with a Senate? So we have to go all the way back to shortly after the Declaration of Independence. As some of you may know, the United States was not always under the current Constitution. Before the current Constitution, there was a document called the Articles of Confederation that was written up shortly after the Declaration of Independence, around 1777, if I'm not mistaken. That's when they started working on it, and it got ratified very quickly. And it was a document that was intended to kind of stitch together the 13 separate colonies into one united nation. But the problem is that it was so weak, the central government or the national government that was formed from it, if you could call it a government, was so weak that everyone knew, even the people who were opposed to having a strong central government, that if they maintained that the system of the Articles of Confederation, the country was not going to last very long. So knowing that, they decided to do a convention, and that was in 1787, and they did it in Philadelphia, and their intent was to get together, have delegates from from all the states coming together and discussing how to strengthen the Articles of Confederation to have a stronger country. And that's how that idea of that convention came about in 1787 in Philadelphia. And Madison was one of the delegates, James Madison, and one of the founding fathers. And he, being from Virginia, went to Philadelphia as a representative of the state of Virginia, you could say. And interestingly, he decided to arrive in Philadelphia before most of the other delegates. He arrived early, and his intent in arriving early was to spend some time thinking about a plan, writing out a plan, so that he could then offer this a set of concrete ideas to the other delegates about setting aside the Articles of Confederation and actually forming a brand new document with new ideas, because he knew that stitching up the Articles of Confederation was not going to do the trick. They needed to chuck that, throw that away, and start with something new, which is what we have to do now. So in a sense, Madison is to be commended for having had that initiative of saying, okay, we need to have the bravery to admit that what we have right now is not going to work, and we need to rewrite it. And he's to be commended also that he decided to spend some time meditating on it. And that's what we have to do in America. We have to start meditating on how to restructure the system, because the current structure is clearly not working out. So Madison arrived in Philadelphia. He started writing out some ideas, and most of those ideas became the foundation of the current Constitution. And in this convention, you could say that there were basically two factions, if you can call it factions, or two groups of people who had like different ideas. One group believed that the country really needed to establish a very strong national central government, and people like Madison were in that group. George Washington was in that group, and even Alexander Hamilton, and they had ideas like forming a central bank. Hamilton had that idea, and so these people wanted a more centralized form of government. And then on the other side, the other faction, if you can call it that, believed in a more decentralized system where the states kind of maintained their power, their sovereignty, because they were afraid of having a strong central government, because they feared that it would descend into some sort of tyrannical leviathan that would take over the freedoms of the people. So they just wanted, preferred to have little leviathans, little state governments oppressing the people, rather than one big central government oppressing the people. So we have these two factions that were kind of colliding, in a sense, in the Constitution, in this convention. And eventually, this convention came to be known as the Constitutional Convention, but That is the name that was given to it later, because the people who gathered there did not gather to write a new constitution. They didn't know they were going to end up writing a new constitution. They just arrived there thinking they were going to do some tweaking to the Articles of Confederation. So in the midst of all that, all the talking, and this convention, by the way, lasted around around 5 months, if I'm not mistaken, from around May of that year until September of that year, 1787. So they went through the spring and the long hot summer in the convention. So it was a lot of heated debate, literally and figuratively. And in the midst of their talking, they ended up having two plans to kind of decide on, amongst other things. But one of the plans was called the Virginia Plan. That was more or less Madison's ideas. And in Madison's ideas about how to have a national legislature, he believed that it had to be bicameral, two houses. And he believed that those two houses had to have popular representation. In other words, elected by the people and be proportional to the population. So, you know, states that were more populous would end up having more representatives in both houses, and states that had less people would have fewer representatives in both houses. And so that was part of Madison's plan in his Virginia plan. And there was another plan called the New Jersey Plan, and it was apparently promoted by a man named Patterson. I don't know if he's the man after whom the city of Patterson, New Jersey is named, but this fellow Patterson had this New Jersey plan. And in that plan, basically what would happen is that the Articles of Confederation would be strengthened. So he didn't want like something new. He just wanted to strengthen the Articles of Confederation, and he wanted to continue the same legislative system as the Articles had, where you had one vote per state in a unicameral legislature. In other words, just one house, and each in that one house there'd be one vote per state. And it was kind of a very simple system where all the states had equal representation and equal authority to decide on legislation. Even if, you know, the state of Rhode Island, being as small as it was, had the same vote as a big state, like say New York or Virginia. So that was his plan, and they fought it out on how to create a new legislature, and eventually they came out with a compromise, and many call it the Great Compromise of the Convention. Because it turned out to be the biggest topic of debate and the biggest point of compromise that had to be reached, and it revolved around this creation of this of the Senate as part of this bicameral system. So considering that there were, you could say, more debate-worthy issues like slavery and other things, that the formation of the Senate is centered around the Great Compromise. That's how big a deal it was, and how much of a compromise it was required to come up with the Senate. That's how the Senate was born, out of compromise, a big compromise. And this Great Compromise has had the system that we have now, where you have two houses, a bicameral system with two houses, you know, the Senate that has equal representation for each state, just like the New Jersey plan had in mind, but in this case, it was two votes per state. And then you have the House of Representatives that had the proportional representation based on population, just like Madison had suggested for both houses. And Madison's idea of a bicameral legislature was kept. So that's kind of how they melded those two plans together, and we had the mess that that we have now. So the question now becomes: why would Madison think of a bicameral system, and why would the other delegates eventually find the idea kind of palatable or acceptable? mean, where did that come from? Was that a revelation? Did Madison have a dream? Did an angel come down from heaven and show him that's how it was supposed to be? Is it in the Bible? I mean, where did it come from? And I don't know the exact answer, literally speaking, but I think I can discern or perceive where Madison got his big idea of a bicameral system. And for that, you just have to just look a little bit across, to the east, across the Atlantic Ocean, and see how things were being done in Britain at the time. And in Britain, there was, and there still is now, a bicameral legislature formed by two houses. As many of you may know, it's the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And the House of Lords is more or less the British equivalent of the Senate, or I should actually say the Senate is the American equivalent of the House of Lords. And then the House of Commons is the equivalent of the House of Representatives. So we can, if that's the case, if the House of Lords is the Senate and the House of Commons is the House of Representatives, what is it? We have to understand what the House of Lords is about. So, and just as a side note, the House of Commons corresponds with the House of Representatives in the sense that it's a representative body elected by the people, just as the House of Representatives here is, and it's more or less proportional by population. It's not exactly proportional, but you could say that it kind of averages out to equal proportion of population. In Britain, there are 650 constituencies, and each constituency gets one MP, one member of parliament, to represent them in the House of Commons. And each constituency has different populations, sizes, but if you average them out, they kind of are more or less the same. There's a fluctuation maybe from the range of 55,000 to 72,000, 73,000, but more or less it's pretty much consistent. So yes, there is a proportional representation of the population per region in the House of Commons. And by contrast, the House of Lords does not have any elected members. And the Senate, as it originated when it started at the beginning, was not popularly elected. Some people are not aware of that. It was until the 17th Amendment that was passed in the early 20th century that the Senate eventually became or popularly elected, elected by the population. In the past, the Senate had been, the senators were elected by the state government. So you had to have influence in the government of your state and with the politicians and the people in your state, and that's how you ended up being in the Senate, because the state legislatures would vote you in and send you to Washington to represent the state. So the Senate did start in a similar way to the House of Lords in that it was not directly elected by the population. And in Britain, in the House of Lords, there are more members in the House of Lords than in the House of Commons. And I think it's one of the few, if not the only upper house in the world where you have that scenario, because generally the lower house, in this case the House of Commons, would have more members than in the House of Lords. But in Britain, they actually have more. I think the current number is around 792. And the number is variable. It's not always the same number. In this House of Lords, you have what they call the Lords Spiritual, and they are, I think, around 26 archbishops or bishops from the Church of England. And then they have the Lords Temporal. So they have these two groups. And the Lords Temporal are comprised of life peers that are appointed by the monarch, or in this case, the queen, at the time of this recording, and they are and they have hereditary peers. So and these peers that are appointed by the monarch, they tend to be nobility. They are people who have nobility titles, and they can pass that title and the privilege of being in the House of Lords to their descendants. And so you have basically a representation of the nobility of people with nobility titles in the House of Lords, and people who, in a sense, represent the interests of the royalty, of the monarch, because the monarch is the one who has authority to put people, appoint people to this House of Lords. So and they have their power has changed over time. They used to have much more influence on the legislature, but it has kind of waned with time. They review and amend bills that come from the House of Commons, and they generally don't have the power to stop a bill altogether. So if the House of Commons has a bad bill or something, they cannot stop the bill, but they can delay it. They can force or tell the House of Commons, you have to, you know, think about this bill, you know, and these are our observations, and we don't like this and that and the other, and you have to go back and debate it. So they have this power to kind of delay things, but they can't really stop it. And it's interesting that that concept of this upper house that is there to kind of get in the way of things, that was adopted by the American version of the House of Lords and taken to new heights. So why was there a House of Lords in Britain? Where did that come from? So we have Madison having this idea from the house from Britain. Now the question is, where did Britain get that idea from? And for that, we have to go all the way back to the 13th century, and to the famous Magna Carta, or its full name is Magna Carta Libertatum, which in Latin means the Great Charter of Liberties. And it was created or decreed by King John. And the reason why King John came up with this was that he had some barons who were some members of the nobility who were ganging up on him and on the verge of rebelling against him. And in order to stop that rebellion, he decided to write this bill and offer it to them as an olive branch to say, hey, can we all get along? And in this Great Charter of Liberties, he basically started giving or recognizing the rights of people who are not within the royal family. And a lot of people think that this was a document directed at the individual citizen, but it was, and yes, in a general sense, you could say it was, but its original direct intent was to recognize the rights of the nobility, of people of the nobility. But it was a revolutionary thought in the sense that there was this absolute monarch who had theoretically absolute power, and somehow he was recognizing that people who were not within his immediate family, who did not inherit his absolute sovereignty, had rights that he had to respect. Like there were boundaries to the rights, to the power that he could exercise even as an absolute monarch. So, and out of that, eventually, you know, we have the House of Lords. So you could say that the House of Lords is a manifestation of the fact that the democratization of Britain began by conceding rights to the nobility. And then eventually those rights, you could say, trickled down, if that, for lack of a better word or term, to the rest of the population. So that's why the House of Lords is there, you could say. And if you think about it also, another big moment in British history that where the the monarchy recognized the rights of the people or people who were not monarchs was in what's called the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Because in England, there was this nasty king called James II, who was becoming very tyrannical, a Catholic king that was becoming very, very bad. And then William of Orange came from Holland and basically invaded England. And he was married to a member of the English royal family. I forget who it was at this moment. But he invaded England, Britain, and he was able to take out James II and become the king of England. And shortly after doing that, he decreed the Bill of Rights, 1689. That's how it's known. It was, I think, drafted in 1688 and then put out in 1689. And this Bill of Rights was, in a sense, the equivalent of the Bill of Rights in the American Constitution, declaring the rights that the individual has, the British individual has. And so it was another case of the king voluntarily conceding authority and recognizing authority in people who were not monarchs. So again, that's why there's this House of Lords, because it in a sense, it's a way of saying to the king, hey, you voluntarily gave us or recognized our authority and our rights and our liberties. So in by the same token, we're going to recognize your authority and your place in our society. And the House of Lords is a way of saying thank you to the king by saying, hey, yes, you've been kind to us, and we're not going to abuse this concession that you've done by just overrunning you and killing you French Revolution style. We are going to admit that you are still our king or queen, whatever the case may be. And the House of Lords is going to be there as a permanent reminder that you still have power. And the House of Lords is comprised of the nobility and the monarchy. So that's kind of the origins of the House of Lords. So if you look behind the veil, you can see that there is a sort of a caste system or an elitism, an air of elitism, a fragrance of elitism. Behind the House of Lords, because it is still believing in this system that separates people into castes, you know, the nobility, the monarchy, and then the common people. And that's why the House of Commons is called the House of Commons. It's like the common people. And some people say, oh, it comes from the House of Communes or Communities. Forget about it. It's saying the common people, you know, the average Joe. And then there are the lords, the big people, and the commons, the little people. So, it's understandable that it is like that in Britain because of the history. But in America, there is no excuse for that, because we didn't have to acknowledge or recognize a king who was conceding rights to the individual. We had the opposite, and we broke away, and we had the chance to start brand new. But we inherited that system of elitism and put it into our framework in the form of the Senate. And that's why the Senate has this air of elitism, because you can see, for example, that they are elected for six-year terms, as opposed to the House of Representatives, where people are elected to two-year terms. So it's and the people in the Senate have to be 35, at least according to the Constitution. I don't remember if it was ever changed, but originally you had to be at least 35 to be a senator, but you only had to be 25 to be a member of the House of Representatives. So it's again this, you know, senior place, the place of the senior people who, because they are more senior, more mature, more bourgeois, they can be there for longer, as opposed to these little ones that come along that we have to kind of keep replacing every 2 years, because we don't know how they're gonna behave. And so we have we can see that there is this air of elitism, and that elitism can also be seen in the way that the Senate was defined in the Constitution because of the privileges it has. You know, because according to Article 1, Section 3, and this is something most Americans know, only the Senate can try do impeachment trials. Only the Senate can decide on impeaching the President of the United States. And according to Article 2, Section 2, the Senate is the one that approves nominees by the President, and they can they are the only ones who can approve Supreme Court nominees by the President. So the President, so if you look in the Constitution, anything that is closely linked to the President involves the Senate, not the House of Representatives, because the Senate is this more elite group that is more, it's preferable to have these people next to the President, to the big guy, just like the House of Lords is right next to the monarch, than to have the House, you know, of Commons, the House of Representatives, interact with the big guy. So that's our, and then in Article 2, Section 2, there's also, it also says, and let me just try to read it here, and there's a paragraph that says, he shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, talking about the President, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. And he shall nominate and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all the other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law, but the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. So you can see that there's this constant thing about the advice and consent of the Senate. So there's this these elders who are sitting there, the wise elders, superior lords who have this knowledge, and the President needs to go ask these wise men and women, you know, what do you think about this? And they are the only ones who can authorize the treaties. You know, by two-thirds of the senators, can the President make treaties? So you can see there's this air of elitism in the Senate, and it comes from its origins in the House of Lords, and also you can see it plastered in the Constitution in a very subtle way. And I think this audio clip has already run too long, and we're going to leave it at that. At least we gave an introduction on the Senate and its origins, and then hopefully in the next audio clip we're going to start discussing in more details why the Senate is such a problem and why we need to get rid of it. Thank you very much.